And assessing for bradykinesia, I mean, I don't know what you think. It's like assessing for an extensor plantar, isn't it? You've got someone who's got a tremor like this, and then you go do this, and you just got this. You're like, well, yeah, you've got clumsy, repetitive hand movements, but do you have decrement?
That was Dr. Adam Cassidy, consultant neurologist, talking about some of the pitfalls in assessing patients with tremor. In this adapted teaching session, turned into a podcast for Tees Neuro, we talk about how to assess tremor in all its many shapes and sizes. We talk about what makes essential tremor essential, what makes dystonic tremor almost impossible, and how to treat tremor when you see it in your clinic.
Okay, so tremor. So basically, Naomi's here, you're here, I'm here. We're theoretically movement disorder specialists. We are movement disorder specialists.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Myself by fiat.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, do you sometimes feel a bit of imposter syndrome with this whole hyperkinetic thing? Or not? I'm asking the wrong guy.
Yeah. I've never had that, no.
Naomi, do you ever have imposter syndrome?
Constantly.
What did
I do when you asked me to talk about ataxia and pretty much everything else?
Binned it. I don't want to do that one. I don't know anything about that one. Yeah, I'm glad you said that though, because I often think, well, I'm really quite good at Parkinson's. Mm. I don't have any imposter syndrome about that, and I don't mind saying that. But as soon as it flips into the sort of hyperkinetic stuff, I start to worry that my credentials are a little thin.
I think it's because certainly for things like dystonia and all of the small print, we never really see it.
Yeah.
Chorea, we see Huntington's and a couple of others, but not much beyond that. I hate seeing patients with tics because I never really know what to do. But I think tremor's okay.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Well, I'm glad you picked... And that's why you picked the topic, isn't it? Because he's like, I get first dibs.
Yeah.
Okay. So... I suppose my first question then is, so you see a patient with a sort of predominant tremor disorder, and let's say, for sake of argument, that we're not thinking about Parkinson's or tremor-dominant Parkinson's. We're quite happy that there's none of the kind of non-motory sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So, how do you kind of approach that in terms of, either in history or more pertinently maybe in examination?
I guess in a very, very simplistic, straightforward way, because there's two ways of thinking about tremor. Ultimately, patients referred to with tremor, the question is does this person have Parkinson's disease or do they have a benign tremor?
Mm.
Whether you want to call that essential tremor or get into the weeds and call about essential tremor plus or dystonic tremor, that is a sort of a nuanced thing that's up in the air, difficult. No one understands what any of these terms are. The etiology is completely poorly understood. There's absolutely no disagreement. It's a total mess.
And, thank God.
And ultimately, the natural history and response to treatment is fairly similar.
Yeah.
So I think it's perfectly reasonable just to answer the question, does this person have Parkinson's disease or, scare quotes, essential tremor?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's quite easy to do.
Yeah, okay.
And I guess the sort of the simple tricks for thinking if someone's got Parkinson's disease is if someone, and again, the great majority of you are going to know these straightforward things, if someone walks into your clinic room and their arm isn't swinging much and that non-swinging arm is shaking, that's almost always going to be Parkinson's. If there's an asymmetric resting tremor of the lower limb, that's almost always going to be Parkinson's. And if there's a head tremor, it is hardly ever going to be Parkinson's. Of course, making sure that you're not thinking about a jaw tremor that's causing the head to move a little bit.
Mm.
But then once you've decided quickly that this is a benign tremor, well, you can really go to town and start to go into all of the intricacies and try and determine exactly what it is. But ultimately, you're going to be recommending propranolol or primidone at the end of it.
And so, if you wanted to make your letter look slightly better.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because it's all about the clinic letter, obviously. There's also a bit of theatre to neurology.
Yeah.
Right, which is fine. How do you, when you're assessing somebody, what components of a kind of tremor assessment should our registrars be able to do confidently?
So, looking at the gait, looking at the face, looking for bradykinesia, and then the tremor. So I guess looking at the tremor starts throughout the whole history, and seeing to what extent it comes and goes. And then all I simply do is get the patient just to sit down, close their eyes, get them to close their eyes because I'm going to stare intently at their head and their face for a few seconds, and it just freaks them out a little bit less if they've got their eyes closed. So looking for any sort of dystonic movements or tremulous movements of the face, looking for some subtle dystonic posturing of the neck or a subtle tremor of the head, and then just looking at the hands. And I guess if you've got a suggestion that there's been a resting tremor that's just sort of disappearing, then some cognitive distraction, so get them to just rehearse the months of the year backwards, and that will usually bring out a resting tremor.
Right.
If there's one lurking about.
Okay.
And then we're looking for a postural tremor, so get them to stick their arms out like this and hold it there, and again, just watch and just see what happens. If there's a resting tremor, does that sort of disappear, and is there a re-emergent tremor? I think most people know that your stereotypical Parkinson's case, which you don't often see really, is a resting tremor like this. Stick your arms out, nothing, and then a lower amplitude, higher frequency postural tremor in the same hands, an emergent tremor. So you're looking for a postural tremor, and then if you've got a postural tremor, you're looking for, is there any dystonic posturing? And we'll come back to dystonic tremor and the definitions and all the rest of it shortly, I guess. So, and again, the jury's out. So a lot of people will say, look at that little finger. Did you see that little finger? It's abducting. That's dystonia. It's not essential tremor, it's dystonic tremor. And a lot of people will take issue with that. But anyway, you document it, and is there any sort of dinner forking, sort of flexion of the wrist and hyperextension of the fingers, so your hand looks like a dinner fork. And then what you're looking for, I guess in a way, maybe it's good to just talk about essential tremor versus dystonic tremor.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like, what is actually the difference apart from that? In Europe, we seem to like dystonic tremor more, and in America, they seem to like essential tremor more.
Yeah. So I guess we can start with the definitions, makes it seem easier than it is. And again, so we're going to get into the weeds here, and it's kind of interesting if you're a movement disorder specialist, but none of this really matters as to what you're going to tell the patient. Because if you've got any sense, you'll tell them they've got essential tremor. Because if you try and explain the concept of a dystonic tremor to a patient, you'll tie yourself up in knots, and there is no website. And then they'll just go home and think they've got DIT 1 dystonia, and they're going to start having horrendous disability. But anyway, I digress. So the definition of dystonic tremor is dead easy, isn't it? It's tremor in a dystonic body part. And it's generally, so I guess if you go back to the definition of dystonia, you know, abnormal involuntary movement with sustained muscle contractions leading to repetitive movements, twisty movements, and abnormal postures. So the repetitive movement bit sort of embeds within the definition of dystonia that there is a sort of tremulous aspect to it. So if you've got a dystonic neck or a dystonic arm and it shakes, well, that's easy, that's a dystonic tremor. But then there are some people with dystonia of the neck, for example, who have no dystonia at all of the upper limbs, but they've got a tremor as well. And people used to come up with crazy ideas to say, well, they've got essential tremor plus neck dystonia, which is a bit of an odd way of thinking about it. So they coined this term dystonia-associated tremor. So tremor in a dystonic person, but not in a dystonic body part. So that's dead easy. But then there's essential tremor. And so the interesting thing about essential tremor is that no one has any idea whatsoever what essential tremor is at all. So it's just a sort of operationalized definition. No one really understands what goes on in the brain in people with Tourette's very well. So it's a tick box for Tourette's, it's a tick box diagnostic list for depression, it's a tick box for essential tremor. So I guess there are lots of different diagnostic criteria. I couldn't word for word give you the 2017 MDS one, but it's along the lines of a largely symmetrical, largely postural tremor of the upper limbs that may or may not affect the head or the voice without any significant associated neurological signs such as Parkinsonism, ataxia or dystonia. So that's what essential tremor is. But the problem is that it probably represents a sort of it's a syndrome. There are probably lots of different individual etiologies because, you know, some of these people have a strong family history, some don't, some are responsive to alcohol, some don't. You get some people that get it in younger age and it sort of plateaus for decades and then kicks off in older age. You get some people getting it in older age, it progresses more quickly, they're a bit more likely to have things like ataxia and dystonia and things that you're not really allowed to have in essential tremor. So no one really knows what essential tremor is.
Good.
And then,
so it's quite liberating then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. but then there was a reappraisal and people started going back to all of the essential tremor cases and going, aha, there's some dystonia. the little pinky is going out, or there's some dinner forking, or look at that head, it's just constantly a little bit of lateral colis. So people then just decided, well, all these people actually don't have essential tremor, they've got dystonic tremor. And then it all just got a bit weird, and no one can really argue as to how much of a bit of dystonia you need. And in my experience, when you're not even assessing someone for a tremor, say you're looking for pseudoathetosis, you get people to stick their arms out, hands out. Loads of people just do this all the time. And some authorities will say, well, actually, this isn't dystonia. Dystonia is sort of sustained muscle contractions leading to sort of twisty movements, overflow of agonist to antagonist, and that's not what we would call dystonia. So no one could really figure it out.
I've got overexcited about Jupiter's contracture on a number of tremor patients as well. Like, aha! Oh. It's your Viking heritage.
So then at the new diagnostic criteria, they came up with another term, which is ET+, just to try and calm all of this down. And you can see where they're coming from.
That's like an extended edition of a 1980s sci-fi with Elliot and
exactly.
And a small friendly alien.
So what they said ET+ is essential tremor as I just sort of vaguely defined it, with some questionable neurological signs. So questionable dystonia, maybe a resting tremor, because some people with essential tremor can have a bit of a resting tremor component, mainly those people that have had it for years. Lots of people with bad essential tremor will report that they're unsteady. You're not supposed to be unsteady with essential tremor, but they are, and if you get them to do a tandem gait, they're worse than they should be. And again, we think about essential tremor as being a postural tremor and a kinetic tremor. Remember, the kinetic tremor is just a postural tremor that continues with movement. The amplitude isn't necessarily increasing as you reach termination. But loads of people with essential tremor, when you look carefully, do have a little bit of an intention tremor. So it sort of encapsulates this idea. And it therefore allows people to continue to use the term essential tremor in response to all this business about, no, everything's dystonic. And it also allows people to make a separation between pure essential tremor and the extra bits to try and sort of drive research forward. And it allows you to just tell the patient as well that they've got essential tremor. And I think, you know, people have done retrospective studies of digging out all of their cases, and they found that maybe 2/3 or more of their old essential tremor cases are actually essential tremor plus. So I guess going back to the original point then, how do you differentiate a dystonic tremor from an essential tremor? I suppose the issues are, is there any subtle dystonic posturing? People with dystonic tremor have more of a task, have more of a postural dependence, so the tremor might be very variable depending on whether you put your arms like this, like this, like this. All we're doing here is just giving the patient the opportunity to put their limbs in a few other random postures to see what happens, and the rhythmicity can alter, it can be a bit more variable, it can be a bit more jerky, it can come and go in flurries. And there's not much more to it than that. So we're looking for a postural tremor, then we'll do finger-nose test, making the patient really reach much more than they did on the video there, and looking, is there a sort of an intention component as well? It's probably useful to assess their gait.
Okay, that's great. So it's, in some respects, benign tremor is reasonable.
Yeah, quote unquote.
And then beyond that, there's a large cohort, therefore, by the sounds of it, of essential tremor patients in Sunderland, a very small cohort of essential tremor patients in Middlesbrough, but quite a large cohort of dystonic tremor patients in Middlesbrough. Which makes me wonder what the split is in Newcastle, Naomi. Like, just out of interest. Like, what do you, like, if you thought about your benign tremor, like, when do you, like, do you have a default?
I default to essential tremor because the treatment is for essential tremor. There is no real treatment for dystonic tremor. I think if it, the asymmetry of it would maybe push it more towards dystonic. And if you think it looks a bit like Parkinson's, tremor dominant Parkinson's, but there isn't any Parkinsonism, that sort of pushes you more towards dystonic tremor. That was where it sort of originally came out, wasn't it? That it was when they just started doing DAT scans and realised all these people with benign Parkinson's.
So that's there are two ways into this dystonic tremor. There's those people who look like they've got essential tremor, and then there's those people that look like they've got Parkinson's disease. So this is actually an important thing to realise, because it's very easy to misdiagnose Parkinson's if you're unaware of this cohort of people.
Mm.
So it's the SWEDs. I mean, many of you probably won't recognise the term SWEDs.
Is that still even used, the SWED thing? Because I think it's died.
No.
Yeah.
So I guess in the late 90s, there were a bunch of drug trials for dopamine agonists, and one of the secondary endpoint measures was whether or not the DAT scans showed increased dopamine uptake. You know, was there some sort of neuroprotective or restorative effect? And there wasn't, of course. But the interesting thing is that 10% of all of these people in these trials had negative DAT scans. And these were people with diagnosis of Parkinson's enrolled by sort of eminent academic movement disorder specialists from throughout the world. And 10% of these people just had negative DATs. No one really knew what this meant. And then over time, these people never really got worse. They didn't really respond very well to levodopa, and their DAT scans didn't change. And people began to realise that they didn't actually have Parkinson's disease. So they just gave them this term SWEDs, subjects without evidence of dopaminergic denervation. So no one uses that term anymore. And then I think in 2007, the Queen Square Group came out and assessed all of their SWEDs patients. And they said, look, these are people who've got an asymmetric resting tremor that fooled us and made us think they had Parkinson's. A lot of them also had a reduced arm swing, so it really looked like Parkinson's. But actually, when you get down to brass tacks, they're not really hypomimic. They're not really rigid, because of course, you know, I'm sure you all know this, anyone with a tremor or essential tremor is going to have cogwheeling. The question is there underlying rigidity between each cogwheel? And that can take a bit of practice and experience to figure out. And assessing for bradykinesia, I mean, I don't know what you think. It's like assessing for an extensor plantar, isn't it? You've got someone who's got a tremor like this, and then you go do this, and you just got this. You're like, well, yeah, you've got clumsy, repetitive hand movements, but do you have decrement? So an easy case would be, right, so you get motor arrest, goes down to zero, or it stops and then restarts again, and that's true bradykinesia. But if you've got someone with a bad tremor, you just can't do it. So a lot of my letters are sort of couched in, you know, his repetitive hand movements were awkward and clumsy, but there was no convincing decremental bradykinesia, which means I don't really know.
I find wrist spinning in that scenario is a little easier, I think, to interpret than finger tapping, because that seems a little easier for patients to do, and I think because it's a bigger amplitude movement, and often Parkinson's patients find that even harder than the finger tapping. So I sometimes do that, but I agree with you. I think for all that we're meant to be really good at picking up bradykinesia, I have a number of patients where I've done the DAT scan because, like, they feel like a benign tremor.
Mm.
They've got a few little kind of soft things,
well,
like
got,
the arm
swing. They've
got swing.
An asymmetric resting tremor,
yeah.
But they don't have all of the meat to it.
Yes, yeah. And they don't have the sort of hyposmia and autonomic-y sort of stuff and dream enactment. So you're like, mostly you think you're all right, and then you, and those are the ones I do DAT scans.
Yeah,
in.
Me too. Yeah. And they're usually negative, and yeah. I keep thinking I need to stop doing them, but. So these people didn't have true bradykinesia. They didn't have rigidity, and when you get down to it, it's a lot of aha, look at this little finger's going out, or there's a bit of lateral collis, and they start to find that the tremors were more positional, that they would come and go in flurries. And so they basically said, look, most of these people in our cohort of SWEDs, we've decided that these people have got adult onset dystonic tremor. And that's when it sort of started to take off, this idea of dystonic tremor. And then they did another paper a few years later where they looked at various sort of biomarkers of dystonia, measures of motor cortex plasticity in response to evoked potentials and TMS. And there were a lot of parallels between a dystonic pathology. So then they all started to say, look, all of these SWEDs and these asymmetric resting tremors, these are dystonic tremor. And so I suppose it's useful in one sense to be aware that there is a population of people out there who really look like they've got an asymmetric resting Parkinson's tremor with a reduced arm swing, but they've got nothing else. You can't convince yourself that they've got bradykinesia, and you probably don't want to be over-diagnosing them as Parkinson's disease.
Yeah.
And I guess another one of my red flags that I used to just make this mistake all the time is if you've got one of these people and you ask them about sleep, and then you just overinterpret obstructive sleep apnea or periodic limb movements of sleep with REM sleep behaviour disorder, So I think lots of people have just random jerks, and it's very easy if you're thinking, oh, isometric rest tremor, okay, that's RBD. But really, are they actually shouting, screaming, swearing, punching, kicking, throwing themselves out of bed? You're sort of looking for those for RBD, not just a general restlessness.
Yeah. All right. So, like, I feel happier. You can say what you want, guys. You can call it essential tremor, dystonic tremor. You're unimpeachable, really, aren't you, in that scenario? Okay. So, the other question then I have, which I find difficult in clinic, because the patient comes in and you quite relatively rapidly you're thinking, oh, it's going to be a benign tremor. So the question I have down here is, have you ever seen a drug actually work for tremor?
Yes.
Oh, you have? Oh, okay.
So I guess before I answer that, what the review articles and what the data suggests and what the talks say is that kind of half of patients respond to medication, and a good treatment outcome is to reduce the amplitude of the tremor by a half. And that's sort of what I say to my patients, and that might be a little bit optimistic, but usually they've already had a trial of propranolol. So I think propranolol does work a lot, and a lot of people get a modest to moderate benefit.
Do you think they've got enhanced physiological tremor rather than an essential tremor syndrome, though?
No, I really don't. I mean, I don't think I see people with enhanced physiological tremor. I mean, these people have quite clear. I mean, it's never really...
Maybe the referral pathway is better in Sunderland. I feel like I see a lot of patients with an enhanced physiological tremor, but... So propranolol, okay. Yeah, I mean, I would... It's rare that that's not already been tried.
Exactly, yeah.
Before you see the patient.
And so what I say to my patients with tremor is that we've got propranolol, which doesn't really cause much in the way of side effects and can work, and then we've got a bunch of other horrible drugs that you're not going to tolerate. But if it's really bad, we'll give it a go. And so the first on the list probably ought to be primidone, because propranolol and primidone are the only drugs with decent evidence, and primidone definitely works well in a small number of people who can take it. Mm. And I'll just be upfront and say way more than half of people stop taking primidone because it zonks them out, makes them feel very sleepy, very dizzy. But I've got a good handful. And again, what you've got to remember is essential tremor is a little bit like migraine in the sense that if you just followed them all up, it'd be game over. You wouldn't have any time to see your Parkinson's patients. So I discharge the vast majority at the first visit with a sort of an action plan, apart from those ones with really severe tremor who I'm thinking, we might be thinking about DBS further down the line. So a good handful will get a lot better on primidone, but most don't. And I've had about 2 or 3 successes with topiramate.
Topiramate, yeah, which does get bandied around a wee bit.
So I think that's the third line. You've got to get up to 100 BD. The 50 BD migraine dose probably doesn't cut it.
But what about clonazepam and tremor?
I just don't do it. I suppose one option for clonazepam is those people with a bad tremor using it as a PRN basis for social occasions, as long as it doesn't sort of make them fall asleep into their nice restaurant dinner. I've tried it a few times and not had much success, and I just don't like the idea of getting GPs to give people a TDS benzo.
I think I sometimes think if they have an alcohol response, they might have a clonazepam response, just in terms of that kind of physiology of that, because there's some overlaps.
Yeah.
But
so have you had much success with clonazepam?
I've got a couple of patients who manage it, including one quite elderly lady who manages a fairly low dose of clonazepam, and when it stopped, her tremor gets significantly worse. Like, she's got a family history of tremor. Hers is particularly bad. She's not suitable for surgical treatment. So we sort of, you roll the dice, don't you, on a variety of things in that scenario. But I do use it a little bit if I think there's quite a clear alcohol response.
I've never ever seen gabapentin work.
No.
And I don't even bother with that. I mean, clonazepam's first line for orthostatic tremor, and it's supposed to be pretty good. Gabapentin's supposed to be pretty good for that, but... yeah, mainly propranolol, primidone, topiramate. I'll chuck in trihexyphenidyl. No one tolerates it. And then if you're still keen for treatment, or if things are bad, then yeah, consider surgical therapy.
I suppose the other thing I do, if I think about it, particularly if there's a family history, particularly if there's a funny little bit of posturing, even if it's subtle, I always give them a month of levodopa on the random chance that it's a dopa-responsive dystonia, which I think, if you don't think about it, you never find it.
So a dystonic, so basically a dystonic tremor that's a weird manifestation of dopa-responsive dystonia.
Yeah. And I think once every 5 years you find somebody in your tremor cohort with dopa-responsive dystonia. But I don't know, I mean...
Did you write a case up with that?
Maybe you find one every 5 years.
Yeah.
I remember reading a case report about this many years ago. Was that
you? Paul Gallagher wrote it. I picked up a kindred in the tremor disorder as a registrar, in the tremor clinic, as a David Burns tremor clinic, as a registrar. Sort of by accident.
Right.
And my approach was, so this was a bit, particularly in that case report, the patient had developed a tremor when she was 17, had been followed up intermittently for 20 years, because she was in her late 30s when I saw her on a whatever afternoon it was, and had been diagnosed with Parkinson's, with functional tremor, with all sorts of things over the years, and then, but clearly had a sort of dystonic tremor, head tremor, voice. It was quite bad. And then the time I saw her, she said...
So not an ET plus.
No.
A clear dystonic tremor.
Yeah, clearly dystonic tremor. And, but really severe. And then she just said, oh, my brother's just developed a tremor, funnily enough. And I was like, oh, right, okay. Well, you know, like, anyway, there's no point following you up, but here's some levodopa. It won't work. If there's a miracle, let Professor Burns' secretary know. And then I happened to be beetling about the secretary office about 2 days later, and David Burns' secretary went, this patient was on the phone this morning and she said a miracle has occurred and you'd know what that meant. and I was like, no, that can't be right. So we brought her back. And then she said, and then she came with her brother, whose tremor was very subtle, and his tremor had gone away on her levodopa, which she'd given him some of. And then I think when we did the genetics, it was DRD, and her mother had a head tremor.
Nice.
And her teenage son had writer's cramp.
Yeah.
So anyway, it became quite an interesting story from a kind of like a punt, basically, on levodopa.
And was there a genetic diagnosis pinned to that?
Yes. So she had a GTP cyclohydrolase 1.
Oh, right. So not how these
deficiency.
People are supposed to present.
So not at all how they're meant
to
present.
These people are supposed to present with...
In childhood.
Limb,
yeah.
Leg... dystonia in childhood.
Yeah, so that's the proper sort of like cerebral palsy mimic of dopa responsive dystonia in childhood.
Yeah, I have.
Is not what. Yeah. And there's a group of late presenting dystonic patients. And of course, family history depends on the time and the place that you're talking to the person. And so she never had a family history until she had a family history.
And have you found any more of these?
Yes.
So in retrospect, yes, I'd. Got one, a patient with an asymmetric resting tremor on levodopa who just absolutely was not getting worse over the first 5 years of Sunderland, and I couldn't convince myself he had any true Parkinsonism, so I turned his world upside down by DATing him, giving him a normal DAT scan, rescinding his diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, upsetting him massively, trying to withdraw his levodopa, and then him thinking that things were getting much, much worse, which could have been a nocebo effect, or he could have been one of those.
Yeah.
So, not many.
Yeah. So, yeah, that particular experience has slightly altered my practice, clearly, like all medicine-based evidence does.
When it hits you.
But, like, do you do that, Naomi, or, like...
Not unless they're very young.
But you don't want to be diagnosing everyone with essential tremor and dystonic tremor and starting them all on levodopa because consultants are going to be wondering what
the
hell is going on.
In the pediatric clinic, when I did the pediatric movement sort of clinic, we try everybody with levodopa.
Yeah.
No matter what's wrong with them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, so I give them a prescription, and I a bit like with polymyalgia, you know, I'm like, this will either be a miracle or it will be completely useless. And I don't want to hear about maybe I feel slightly better sort of thing. And that, I think that's the way. And then you sort of like if it should, dopa responses should get markedly better on a tiny dose of dopamine. or levodopa, and it should not get better for any other good reason. And so, like, a really small dose for a couple of weeks, I do that in pretty much all of my patients now.
Interesting. Yeah, something to think about.
Well, that's the thing. That's the worry, isn't it? I suppose with any of these things.
Which I suppose adds a bit more weight to maybe being less dismissive than I am and a little bit more interested in whether it's a true dystonic trial.
Ah, life's a journey. Okay, well, look, I mean, maybe time for a question or two from the floor, definitely. I think, because we're on time. Any questions, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested, I guess you're saying there's not really much distinction phenomenologically between dystonic and ET, but then in terms of treatments, is it important to make the distinction because dystonic, I guess you might have for Botox earlier on?
No, because I think you don't treat limb tremor with Botox. So clearly if someone's got a head tremor, well, it doesn't matter whether you call it dystonic tremor or essential tremor, the treatment of choice is Botox into the neck. Medications just don't work for head tremor. But I think the order in which you would choose the medications is the same. There's a sort of a theoretical argument for saying, oh, it's dystonic tremor, we should give trihexyphenidyl. I don't think there's any real evidence behind that, and I'm not, in my own experience, isn't very positive. Certainly when you get down to DBS, you're still going to stick your DBS leads in the ventromedial thalamus, irrespective of whether or not you've got a few little bits of dystonia. So it's not really going to alter what you do unless, of course, you make the life-changing serendipitous discovery that it's levodopa responsive.
Or you get into, I suppose occasionally you get people who do like EMG guided Botox, and like, you know, that's, you know, you can see about 3 patients a day if you get into that, and you can kind of like Botox very selective kind of muscles.
I think
that's tricky.
The evidence is that it works, but in the trials, the reduced tremor didn't translate into improved functional outcome scores, and I don't really understand why. And the main risk is a lot of people just get weak hands and wrists. And then people have said, well, the reason for that is because we've been too rigid and formulaic, everyone's getting the same protocol. So then you can do EMG guidance or sort of kinematic analysis where you can sort of put stickers on and video them. And then you're getting into something that's super specialist and just takes a Botox operator all day to do one patient. And we can't be sending this kind of stuff to Walker Gate Park. So it's not really something that we do in the UK.
And surgery is great. DBS is a very good treatment.
Absolutely. DBS is an incredible treatment.
And perhaps the MR-guided focused ultrasound will find a place. Although whatever you do with that, you can only do to one side of the brain. Bilateral sort of thalamotomies, essentially, which is what that is, have a very difficult side effect profile. You'd have to be very careful. And that's what my patient who went for it, and he was 83. I still see him in Whitby, 83 on anticoagulants. I was like, I would not recommend this treatment. He's Parkinson's as well, so like, sort of outside some of the evidence base, which is more for benign tremor disorders. And I said, I don't think you should have this. But he went, had it down in London. It's been brilliant. It's worked really well, so what do I know?
We can now refer to Liverpool. I referred someone about 4 months ago, and they've just been seen. Hmm. I think that there's going to be a tidal wave of referrals, because if you think about how many people have essential tremor in the north of England that don't want to have their brain drilled into, I think referrals are going to pick up, and I'm surprised that there isn't like a year-long waiting list already.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's only unilateral, and I think the side effect profile is a bit troubling. The evidence says that I think 9% of people had a gait disorder and 15% of people had persistent paresthesia after it. So I don't really know what that entails. I'm quite keen to have
it's a deliberate targeted stroke, isn't it? Effectively, so. You know, patients, I think, have this notion with ultrasound and an MRI that
it's cozy and safe.
I don't know, like, is it's like an Indian head rub. or something, but it's absolutely not.
So you're not really lesioning the brain in DBS if you do it properly, and you can just turn the electrodes off. It's temporary, but you're burning a hole in the brain, and if it's in slightly the wrong place, well then it's in the wrong place.
Drilling holes in the skull and frying holes in the brain is probably not the best way to think about advanced functional neurosurgery for movement disorders, but we're a fairly informal bunch at Tees Neuro. And I'm pretty grateful to Adam and to Naomi Warren, the other voice you heard on that podcast, another movement disorder specialist from the Northeast, for giving up some of their time to teach our registrars and you. Join us again for another Tees Neuro Movement Disorder podcast soon.